Wouldn't be the first time I've stood with my back to the audience. I remember at least one wedding here one time. The bride and groom decided they wanted to face the audience, so that meant that I was standing with my back to you. The couple I introduced at the end of that wedding was Dave and Janet Gentry, about 26 years ago or so. So it wouldn't be the first time, but I think since it's possible to turn this back, I'll just go ahead and face you today. We were talking this morning about 2 Corinthians chapter 5, the first 8 verses, and trying to make 4 points from that. The first point is that the next body is the best. It's better than this body that we have here. The next body is the best. Paul said, I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not even worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. And then right after that, he says that the anxious longing of the creation, the created universe, everything we see around us, it waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. The whole universe is waiting for the time when the sons of God become what God really has intended for them to be all along. And he says, we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for the redemption of the body. There's 2 things that Jesus did, at least, when he died on the cross. One was redeem our spirits, and the other was purchase our body. The body has been purchased. It's the purchased possession, but it hasn't been redeemed yet. That comes at the end. It comes at the resurrection. Paul is saying here in this passage, I'm getting tired of this tent. There's death working in it already. It's decaying. This body is starting to put tremendous limits on me. That's what he's saying here. I want my building. I want the permanent thing. Paul's not talking about that he doesn't like what he sees in the mirror. He's saying that I wish I had a different shaped nose. That's not the idea at all. He's not dissatisfied with his body in that way. But he knew that the flesh is the beachhead for iniquity, and he's just ready to be rid of it and go on to the next stage. And I think we can all identify with wanting to get that building from God. We appreciate this building, this tent that came through mom and dad, but we want that one from God. The best our parents could give us as a tent was a tent with a lot of weaknesses, genetic and otherwise. And its transitory character, its temporary usefulness is limited. We want that building from God. That house not made with hands, but by divine agency. You know that phrase in the New Testament? And old, not made with hands, is very interesting. Jesus said in the 2nd chapter of the book of John, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And commenting on that, in Mark chapter 14, verse 58, the Jews said, we heard this man say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. The resurrection body of Jesus Christ was a body made without hands. Colossians 2:11 refers to the circumcision that is made without hands. That means not a physical circumcision, but a spiritual circumcision. Hebrews 9:11 says that Christ being come an high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. So summarizing these statements, Christ had a body, a resurrection body, not made with hands. There is a circumcision, not made with hands. When Jesus went to glory, he entered a tabernacle, not made with hands. What does not made with hands mean? Not made with hands means not man-made, not created by human beings, not part of this creation. Paul wants a building that's not like the one that he has in this life. Rather, it is eternal in the heavens. Chad Freeman was the man who educated me about real estate, that the 3 most important things in real estate are number 1, location, number 2, location, and number 3, location. That's how important location is. And now Paul wants to be in heaven with a body that is suited to that place. The location is everything. He wants this perfect vehicle, his new body, for the expression of whatever his transformed nature needs to express in praising and serving God in that new location. He's moving to a new place. How is God going to resurrect us? He's not going to have to go through all sorts of grass and cows to reassemble your molecules together. The fact is that if you're as old as I am, and most of you are, or you're getting there, you've already had several bodies already. You haven't had the same body since you've been born. Well, in one sense you have, but in a real physical sense, you haven't had the same body since you were born. I've heard that every 7 years, and I've also heard that every 3 years, all the cells in your body are replaced. I don't know which one of those is true or if either one of them is true, but I'm sure that everything that's in our body now used to not be in our body. It's been changed out. Probably half the dust in your house is just you. It's just little pieces of you that fall off as you walk around. Paul deals with this a great deal in the 15th chapter of the 1 Corinthians letter. How are we going to understand the resurrection body? Some man will say, how are the dead raised up and with what body do they come? He gives an illustration from nature and he gives then a series of comparisons. And then he says in verse 42 of 1 Corinthians 15, so also is the resurrection from the dead. And then he gives a series of contrasts. First a series of comparisons, and then he says, so also is the resurrection of the dead. And then he gives a series of contrasts in that tremendous chapter. The resurrection body will be imperishable, it'll be glorious, it'll be powerful, and it will be spiritual. It cannot die, it does not diminish, it does not decay. It does not deteriorate. It never grows old. It's never replaced. It will manifest the glory of God. It is able to do things on a heavenly plane, the likes of which we cannot fathom here. It transcends anything we know as natural. In verse 45 of 1 Corinthians 15, he makes the contrast between the first man, Adam, and the second man, Adam. Adam was physical. From his own loins, the human race has sprung. Adam had a certain kind of body, and we have the same kind of body that Adam had because we're descended from Adam. But the last Adam, Christ, is a life-giving spirit. When you're in this world then, you're like Adam. When you're in glory, you're like Christ. We shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. We'll be like him in his resurrection body. His resurrection body is the prototype, and we will be like him. So he says in verse 49 of 1 Corinthians 15, as we have borne the image of the earthy, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly. The prototype is the resurrection body of Christ. He could go through walls, and yet he was recognizable. He walked, he talked, he ate. And I don't understand how that all worked. How does a resurrection body process physical fish? I don't know how he did that. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I don't even have to have an idea about that. The point is, we'll have an actual body. And we're not going to be floating clouds. We're going to be real people. You're not going to be Casper the Friendly Ghost. You will still be you, but with a new, superior body. Back in 2 Corinthians 5 then, Paul says, if my tent is taken down, I'm moving to a better location, a better neighborhood, into a building that God is preparing for me. The next body is best. And that's why we can look forward to that. Also, another point, the next life is perfect. I want to read a couple more verses, although Dale read them this morning. 2 Corinthians 5, verses 2 through 4. In this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house which is from heaven. If so be that being clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we that are in this tabernacle do groan, being burdened. Not for that we would be unclothed, but clothed upon, that mortality might be swallowed up by life. Paul wanted what is mortal to be swallowed up by life, in the fullness of life. In this house we groan, he said. We are uncomfortable in this body. He's talking about putting on a new house as if it were clothing. We, having put it on, shall not be found naked. Being naked would be in a condition where you didn't have your resurrection body. This is the bodily resurrection that he's talking about in John chapter 5, the general resurrection at the end of time where everybody is given a different body. Now, in the Roman world, at the time that Paul wrote this, Gnosticism was gaining ground. It said, matter is evil, spirit is good. One of the Roman thinkers said, the body is a tomb. We need to escape from the body. Plotinus said that he was ashamed that he even had a body because the body was so vile. Epictetus, another Roman philosopher, said of himself that thou art a poor soul burdened with a corpse that you're having to carry around. Seneca wrote, I am a higher being and born for higher things than to be the slave of my body, which I look upon as only a shackle put upon my freedom. In so detestable a habitation dwells the free soul. These people all wanted to be released from their bodies, but Paul is different from them. Paul is not just looking for release from this body, he's looking for the next body. The next body is best. Paul is not looking for nirvana, where he'll be a disembodied spirit. Paul is not just looking for a freedom as a disembodied spirit. He's not waiting for the day that he's going to get absorbed into the infinite. Paul wants a body. He was designed by God to have a body. He was promised by God that he'd have a body. He wants a body in which he can be like Christ. Dualism and the principles of Gnosticism were effectively finding their way into the church. Paul had left Timothy at Ephesus to charge some that they teach no other doctrine, neither give heed to fables and endless genealogies which minister questions. What were these doctrines about that Timothy was fighting there? We don't know all about them. But in 2 Timothy 2:17, Paul mentions Hymenaeus and Philetus, who had gone astray from the truth and were upsetting the faith of some. How? They were saying that the resurrection is past already. What did that mean? What did they mean by that? We don't know for sure. That's all we're given there. But possibly they were saying that there's only one resurrection, and that's a spiritual one. You had your resurrection at your baptism, and when you rose to walk in newness of life, that's all the resurrection that there is and is going to be for you. That may be what they were teaching. At any rate, there was a prevailing confusion in the first century church about whether there would be a real corporal resurrection in the future. And Paul says there absolutely will be. Paul is not looking to be a spirit floating out there somewhere. The ancient philosophers longed for the nakedness of the soul, but Paul did not. The day we receive our glorified bodies will be the height, and that's what Paul is looking for. And it's going to happen in a moment in the twinkling of an eye. And the most we can be prior to that are just the spirits of just men made perfect, as the writer of the Hebrew letter talks about in Hebrews 12:23. They have not yet received their resurrection bodies, but they're waiting for that time. Now, you can't read time into eternity, and I don't believe that those who are waiting for their new body in the next world are in any way unhappy with their waiting if they're on the Lord's side. We're not talking about time there as we know time here, but we are talking about a realization on the part of those saints that are already in the next world. We're talking about a realization on their part that there is something yet that is to be accomplished. There is something that they are anticipating. Paul wanted that glorified body, which would bring him to the perfection where he would be like his risen Lord. And Paul was not satisfied just with the redemption of the soul. That's important. You can't do business without it, but that's not all there was to it. Paul longed for the body as well. He wanted the fullness of everything that God had for him, body and soul together as they should be. Augustine said one time, we don't desire to be deprived of the body, but to be clothed with its immortality. And that's not a bad way of putting it. If Adam had not sinned, he wouldn't have been divested of his body, but he would have been clothed upon with immortality and incorruption, that his mortal body might have been absorbed by life. And he would have passed then from a natural body to his spiritual body. We're just intended by God to possess a body through which we can glorify God. So the next body is best, and the next life is perfect. Another point, the next existence fulfills God's purpose. This is what it's all about. This is what everything is moving toward and marching to get to. I'll read the fifth verse, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 5. Now he that hath wrought us for this selfsame thing is God, who also hath given unto us the earnest of the Spirit. Gave us the Spirit as a pledge. Romans 8:28. All things work together for them that love God, to them who are all the called according to his purpose. Paul is looking at the purpose that he exists for, the reason that he has existence in the first place. And that purpose for Paul and for every one of us absolutely transcends time. Time isn't even the main thing. Time is just the testing ground. This is a purpose that was planned in eternity past, and it's going to be fulfilled in eternity future, and time is just a little blip in the middle of that. Paul didn't feel the way that he felt about this issue because some friend had come along and pumped him up in the face of death, or because he had a momentary boost of adrenaline, or because he happened to be on the upside of his emotions on the day that he wrote this. Paul faced his death as he did because he knew that this was the unfolding purpose of God's plan. Death is an event to get past for all of us. Death is an event to get past. Those who have passed on already are just ahead of us in the program. The Spirit is God's pledge that his purpose will be fulfilled. Arabon, the word translated as pledge or guarantee or earnest here, means an engagement ring, a down payment, a first installment, a security, a guarantee. Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. If you don't have him, you're not a Christian, Paul says. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 21 and 22, we have this point again. He sealed us, he gave us the Spirit in our hearts as a pledge. And again, in the first chapter of the Ephesian letter, verse 13, you were sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise, who is given as a pledge of our inheritance with a view to the redemption of God's own possession to the praise of his glory. The Holy Spirit is given then as a guarantee that God is going to redeem his own possession, which is your body. Your body is the purchased possession, but it has not been redeemed yet. It'll be redeemed at the resurrection day. So the fourth and last point I wanted to make here is that the next dwelling is with the Lord. First was the next body is best. Second is the next life is perfect. Third, the next existence fulfills God's purpose. And finally, the next dwelling is with the Lord. I'll read verse 6. Therefore, we are always confident, knowing that whilst we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. Paul was willing, and in our better moments, we're willing for that same thing to happen as well for us. Paul preferred to be at home with the Lord. Didn't Paul love the people here? Absolutely, he loved the people here. But he loved the Lord more. Who do you love the most? Paul's attitude is not the result of some emotional high. He's got a settled confidence about this. This life is just a race to finish. It's just a battle to win. This life is just a stewardship to honor. There's no reason to unduly clutch at this life. Yes, of course, we ought to take advantage of the medical progresses in our time and do the best we can with that. But we hold on to life only so that we can still be of service. There's no reason beyond that to clutch this life and try to just hold on to it as long as possible. We need to live with purpose and we need to die with meaning. The reason we stay here is service. And when our service is done, we should be as eager as Paul to go ahead and leave. We're of good courage because of what we know. Paul here is talking as if he is experiencing a kind of a heavenly homesickness. I don't know if you've ever been homesick or not, but they tell me it's just like a regular sickness to be homesick. And I get that sense from Paul here, that he's got this heavenly homesickness within him. Of course, if you're getting persecuted as much as he did, that would bring it on. This is what Abraham felt when he was looking for a city whose builder and maker is God. He didn't understand all about it back in that early time, 4,000 years ago. But he understood enough about it to be looking for that city. In Revelation 21, it says three times that God will be among them. Abraham will be there having finally found that city whose builder and maker is God. He says here, we walk by faith and not by sight. This explains how we can serve an invisible God that we can't see. It explains how we can hope for an invisible place that we can't see. We do it by faith, not by vague superstition. We believe and we live by that belief. This is a solid belief that is backed by evidence. We don't know much about heaven. We do our best to try to understand Ezekiel's description of it, if that's even what Ezekiel was talking about. But we don't know much about heaven. We do our best to try to understand John's description of it in the last couple chapters of the Bible. But we don't know much about heaven. We didn't get much help from Paul about heaven, because when he came back from being there, he couldn't even tell us anything. He said he wasn't allowed to even talk about it. Jesus said, blessed are they who do not see and yet believe. I can't see heaven, never have seen it. None of us can see it, but we believe though we don't see. So, the point of all of this in verse 8 is we are of good courage. To some extent or the other, each one of us has that heavenly homesickness within us. To some extent, and I think more as we age, we get more excited about going home. Right now, our communication with the Lord is just through letters and phone calls. His word is the letters, and the phone calls are our prayers to Him. It's just letters and phone calls, letters and phone calls. I remember Lynn being down in Mexico years ago. This was long before email, long before Facebook or any of these modern electronic means that we have. We couldn't call each other on the telephone, and we just communicated by letters. Sometimes I would write her as many as three times a day. And it was a pleasure. As I came home from where I was in Lawrence, Kansas at that time, I would come home to my place where I was living, helping a man with his dogs out in the country. And I would go to the mailbox in the moonlight, and if there would be a letter from her from a far country, that was just, the book Proverbs says it's like medicine. It's better than medicine to get a letter from a far country. Right now, our communication with God is in this matter. His word is our letters, and our phone calls to Him are our prayers. But if we had the choice, we would be with Him. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of His saints for this reason. And it ought to be precious to us too, if it's precious to Him. We're making our way like pilgrims to the celestial city. This morning when I was introducing this subject, I quoted from Thanatopsis, which is quite a piece of work written by William Cullen Bryant when he was a mere 16 years of age. I read that and I think, are we sure that a 16-year-old wrote this? Because it's so profound. It's an ode to death. Thanatos is the Greek word for death, and Thanatopsis was an ode to death. I quoted a little bit of the early part of it this morning just in introducing this subject, but I didn't quote the end of it, which is really the prominent part of the poem. These are the lines that people years ago used to be forced to memorize when they were in school. Now we don't memorize Thanatopsis anymore. They've got a lot more important things to do in school these days, in the public school system these days, according to them. But I still like these lines, and to think that he was only 16 when he wrote this is stunning. So live that when thy summons comes to join the innumerable caravan that moves to that mysterious realm, where each shall take his chamber in the silent halls of death, thou go not like the quarry slave at night, scourged to his dungeon, but sustained and soothed by an unfaltering trust. Approach thy grave like one who wraps the drapery of his couch about him, and lies down to pleasant dreams. If we're a child of God living faithfully for Him, we can approach death in exactly that way. When we lie down at night, we can realistically say, Lord, if I wake up in the morning, I'll take that as just an extra day from You to go out and try to do Your work. But if I don't wake up in the morning and You take me in the night, that's so much the better. What a wonderful way to be able to approach life and to approach death. Once again, we conclude by extending the invitation, never knowing the hearts of those who are present. We'll leave this message with you and hope that if there are any fine tunings or big changes that need to take place in anybody's lives, we will be able to inspire each other along that correct pathway. If we can assist you in a public manner through the extension of the gospel invitation, let us know how we can help you as we stand together now and sing the concluding song.